The frogs.
Bollocks.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. How's it going? Thank you so much for coming back and joining us for episode 8. How did we get here?
Oh, I know. It's gone by so quickly.
So quickly. I thought, okay, we're going to do 10 episodes in a series. It's going to, you know, be a good couple months. No, it's like gone by in a flash. I mean, we still obviously got a few to go, but I'm loving it.
Yeah, I know. It's weird. We never really thought, well, we always imagined we'd do a podcast and then we're finally doing it. And yeah, we're really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It gives us a chance to actually like sit down, decompress, have a chat.
Yeah.
And, you know, get geeky, which is what we love to do.
Get weird.
Get geeky. We've woken up quite early to do this podcast today because, well, over the last week, it has been busy. And it's a busy day today as well. So we're kind of working in and chatting wherever we can.
Yeah. And this is the first one that we're doing completely separately. You're all the way down south, 600 miles away.
Yeah.
I'm all the way up north. And we're doing this over Zoom. But we've kind of got the technology to work. So hopefully it should sound as it normally does. It should sound like we're next to each other, hopefully. But no, we're 600 miles apart.
We are so far. What, do you so miss far? Me?
Of course. Do you miss me?
Sure.
Yeah. That's a classic theme of the show. It's just being abused by Megan.
Of course I do. Of course I do. It's quite nice, actually, getting to do the podcast like this. No.
It's quite nice, actually.
No.
Full stop.
That's not what I meant. But getting to do a podcast, because normally when we have a catch up, we you know, because it's been such a busy time for both of us, it's been like a few minutes here and there. But I get to chat to you now for like a whole hour.
Yeah.
Which is lovely.
Yeah, you cannot escape.
No.
You have to talk to me. Not allowed any excuses.
There's never any excuses.
This is the scheduled time for us to communicate.
If there's a scheduled time, we're in deep trouble.
Yeah. So go on then, what have you been up to in your busy schedule?
I've had such an epic week. It's been the busiest week of the year so far for me. I have been doing, I don't know, very, very long days every single day, but I've been enjoying every single second of it. So on Monday it was Earth Day, which actually I'm going to talk about a little bit later because I've got some insights into Earth Day, which I'd like to share. So I was on This Morning, which was good fun. I went to the This Morning Forest to talk about seabirds and plastic pollution. So that kicked off that day really well. And then I went to London Zoo actually in the afternoon to record a show for Radio 4, which will be aired later on. But I met a amazing scientist called Karim, who spent 30 years studying bush crickets. And he told me that bush crickets have some of the largest testicles, or gonads really. They don't have testicles like mammals do, but the largest gonads of any animals, like 30% of their entire body. That was an interesting
30%.
Fact. 30%. Yeah. I did not expect that from a bush cricket, but there you go. Yeah. He spent 30 years studying the reproduction. And I love this because you get to meet scientists that know way more about really, really niche things than you, which was amazing. But yeah, I met a few really cool scientists from the Natural History Museum and from, Karim worked for Bug Life. Shout out to Bug Life, amazing charity, amazing organisation. So yeah, it was really good. Enjoyed doing that. I've had a few days filming, just been enjoying the wildlife where I can actually. Oh, but actually, I do have something to say, because I have started my theatre show tour.
Yeah.
I've done 2 dates this week, one in Eastleigh, one in Sturminster Newton. And they've been going really well, really well. Been talking about my book, Atlas of Endangered Species, about species right on the brink of extinction and how we can pull them back. So it's kind of celebrating these amazing animals and the weird and wacky conservation tactics it takes to save them. And talking about the scientists that dedicate their whole careers to looking after these animals. Sometimes, actually, in some cases, they've dedicated so much time and never actually even seen them in the wild themselves.
Yeah,
so
incredible.
It says a lot, really.
And go on then, so if people want to see you on your talk tour, where can they go see you?
Well, all information can be found on my website or my social media. But head to my website, www.meganmccubbin.com. Got a few dates in the north of England and Scotland. I'm really keen to do more dates, though. So if you happen to know of a venue or are a venue and would like me to come and chat, let me know, because I'd be more than up for it.
Yeah, I've been to quite a few of your talks, and they are brilliant. You get the kind of the crowd going, the crowd enthused about nature, some really funny personal anecdotes. So yeah, if you do get the opportunity, go and see Megan, and she might have a few books as well with her that she can sign and give to you.
Oh, sweet, thank you. I always feel like I drag you along to all my stuff, so please do actually enjoy it.
No. You personalise them as well. You kind of make sure every talk is just a little bit different than the other ones. So it's just quite nice to be able to, learn more for every talk.
Oh, that's very sweet. Appreciate that. That's very nice. You cutie.
I know.
Right, well, what have you been up to, though? Because you've had a different kind of week to me.
Mine's been quite varied as well. I've been doing, a good amount of filming. It's picking up this time of year. Doing some more survey work, which has been quite nice. But I've been trying to get the garden ready for spring because things are just about starting to bloom. The daffodils are still in peak show. The sparrowhawk came into the garden. This week,
that's cool.
It came and nabbed a chaffinch and was plucking it right in front of my eyes, which was pretty cool. All the birds were going crazy, of course. They were like, get out of here, you. Sparrowhawk didn't care. And just pecking apart this chaffinch, which is obviously not so great for the chaffinch, but this is amazing to see the kind of the circle of life in action in the garden.
It's an important bit of life, isn't it? I know some people get turned off by predation, but I find it fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's amazing to be able to witness that kind of behaviour. And it's, it isn't... Sometimes it's not an easy watch, obviously. I think, nature documentaries kind of sugarcoats a lot of the brutal realities that exist in the natural world.
Oh,
but
yes.
That's fine, it is quite hard to stomach. I appreciate that. But, it's an important part of ecology. So amazing to be able to see that in action. We've had the badgers have been coming back to the garden.
Oh, have they?
Yeah, they've been coming quite regularly. We've had three in the garden last night, which was really cool. In the winter, they were less active. They don't hibernate. They just kind of go into this state of like torpor where they just don't do that much. They sleep in, they keep warm and only go out every now and again. So we didn't see them that much this winter. But now that it's getting warmer and brighter, yeah, they're coming to the garden every single night at the same time. And yeah, three.
That's so. Any cubs?
No cubs yet. I'm sure they'll be there, if not about to be there. But yeah, we only feed them a supplement. We kind of just give them a scattering of peanuts already. So they're not reliant on our garden. They just come in for a little tasty snack, which is quite cool.
No, oh, they're really nice. And I really miss them. I love that we kind of, when we're in the living room, we kind of suddenly pause the TV or stop what we're doing. And we'll be like, oh, I feel like there's a badger outside, and then we'll just run to the back door to see if they're there or not. We get this like sixth sense if the badger's there. Sometimes we're wrong, but sometimes we're right, and it's really nice when we are.
It feels good when we're right. Yeah, it's like, whoa, we're at one with the badgers. We're on the same wavelength. We know where they are.
Yeah, we're part of the clan. But hey, I found a video, right, that I wanted to put on the podcast.
Oh yeah.
Because it's just about the audio, and it really made me laugh. And I thought others might enjoy it too. So let me just get it up. So I find it quite interesting all across Europe and all over the world. People have lots of different competitions. And I found a video where there is a seagull impersonation competition.
I've heard about this, yeah.
Okay, I thought we'd play it. Are you ready?
That's brilliant. So good. I mean, fair play. They're pretty good.
Yeah, they're really good. And I love the fact that it's held in like some sort of bar and it is packed. There are so many people that have gone to see these people who, by the way, you can't see because obviously it's on a podcast.
Yeah.
But they were also dressed up as seagulls. I mean, I know I can't say this term seagull, there's no such thing, but I think for the purpose of this competition, they're doing a generic sea space gull. Thing. So
yeah, I think the winner was kind of doing quite a good herring gull impression.
Yes.
Kind of the cackling herring gull.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. But can you go on and give us your seagull impression?
Oh, God. I didn't even know how to start. Okay.
I know most your family's currently sleeping. We're doing this quite early in the morning. So
yeah.
It's about time they wake up.
It's about time they wake up. Sorry to my brother. Okay, ready? Sounds like a dog.
I mean,
that sounded like my poodles.
I mean, I think you'd still place in the competition, not very highly, but I think you'd still place somewhere.
Last place.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
What the fact?
This week's theme for What the Fact is hunting.
Dun dun dun.
On the theme from our sparrowhawks hunting, we decided that we'll go for a hunting theme and talk about all things predator.
I love predators. I really do. The way that they shape the ecosystem, the way they manage the prey populations below them, like without predators, our environment would just collapse instantly, pretty much.
Well, that's kind of evident in the UK. We haven't got any big predators, so our deer numbers have gone up. Our meso predators, the predators that get predated themselves, they're unable to be kept in check. This is the problem. If you don't have the predators controlling the things below them, then the things below them can just run amok.
Well, everything gets out of balance, and nature is all about balance.
So go on then. Do you want to go first this week?
Okay. And I have gone for an animal which might surprise people when you think of hunters. Because when you think of hunters, you typically think of large mammals. But large mammals, let me tell you, are pretty terrible at hunting. Mm. Generally, their success rate is pretty low.
Yeah.
So, for example, lions, terrible hunters. They only kill about 25% of the time that they try to. Leopards, a bit better, but only 38%. And of course, this all depends on the conditions and things. Wild dogs, on the other hand, obviously social animals, they are pack hunters. They do far better and they have an 80% success rate.
Mm.
However, do you know what the most efficient hunter on the planet is? For the highest success rate of kills?
I do.
Yeah.
Do you want me to say?
Go on.
It's the dragonfly.
It is the dragonfly. Dragonflies are the most brilliant expert hunters with a catch rate of 95%.
It's phenomenal, isn't it?
Remarkable. And when you see them, you obviously see that flash of colour around your pond or around a stream or river, whatever freshwater ecosystem you're with. And you get these little darting arrows that just catch the sunlight, and they've got their beautiful iridescent wings. But you don't really realise this ferocious nature that lies underneath. And they are ferocious in their nymph stage, so when they're young and living under the water. And then when they emerge as adults and then they start to feed on things like flies, mosquitoes, they have to obviously be as fast as their prey. So something like a mosquito and flies obviously has a really high reaction time and is able to move very quickly throughout its environment. And scientists thought for a long time that dragonflies were able to catch their fast-moving prey simply by being reactionary. So they would watch their prey's movements, and if they change direction, you'd change direction as the dragonfly. But this has recently been disproven by a study using a ball that imitates a prey, so a fly or a mosquito, and using dragonflies. And what they were able to determine is that dragonflies have predictive powers. So they're able to anticipate by sight where their prey, or in this case in the study, the ball, will go. They're able to ready their body and snatch it in the air by just guessing the angle and the speed at which their prey is flying at.
Amazing.
Really cool.
Yeah, incredible amount of intelligence from, a relatively small, animal.
Yeah, really smart. By being able to second guess where their prey will fly to next and steer themselves accordingly, they can lock onto their target visually because they've got highly complicated compound eyes, which can see in ultra colour. So we obviously see many different colours. Dragonflies can see a lot more than we can. They've got very complicated eyesight. So using their eyes, they can orientate their bodies, lock onto that prey, and basically estimate the flight path for the ultimate interception of their prey. Enables them to catch from behind and beneath, which is obviously the prey's blind spot too. So it's just amazing that they can position themselves not only where the prey will end up, but also put themselves in a position that they won't be seen because they know where their prey's blind spot will be.
Yeah. It's almost like, when you see the movies of like fighter jets and they lock on a target and they've got this kind of like square grid that locks on somewhere for them to shoot the missile. I imagine that's kind of what dragonflies are doing. They kind of lock onto their target. They kind of predict the trajectory, and then they kind of swoop in behind and bite them on the back of the head.
Yes.
They're just so well calculated. They're like little flying mathematicians, physicists, and mentalists all at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. They're little, mathematicians. I quite like that analogy. But there is also something else going on at play here. And I know we've spoken about it before when a listener sent in a question asking about how animals perceive time. And I explained then that animals perceive time in an entirely different way, and it all depends on how fast their brain can process information. And this is very much a visual thing. So how much of our environment in the light can we process quickly in order to make snap decisions and judgments and react accordingly? But obviously this is quite hard for scientists to be able to judge about, you know, time perception in different animals. But there was one study that was absolutely fascinating. And they found that fast-moving animals, especially small ones that fly, or actually top ocean predators, perceive time more quickly than others. So that means that they're able to process more frames per second than slower-moving animals lower in the food chain. So by processing more frames per second in your head, you're able to process information a lot faster. Now, the slowest animal that they found to perceive changes in their environment and react was the starfish, which was right at the bottom, bless it. But the fastest was the dragonfly, which can perceive information 5 times faster than humans. So they're essentially living in a world that is 5 times quicker than us, perceiving so much more information in such a smaller time frame, which is giving them the ability to react quickly and also anticipate their prey's movements.
Amazing. Do you know, I'd love to go back to the Jurassic period, or the, I don't know, the period before Jurassic, I don't know, long, long, long time ago, when dragonflies were the size of like geese and swans and eagles and things. They were enormous. Imagine seeing that.
I know
how intimidating that must be, and what noise they must make. I mean, they're pretty loud and you can hear them when they're flying right next to you. Imagine how loud that would be. A bloody dragonfly that's massive flying right next to you, it'd be terrifying.
It would be quite something. I mean, it'd be like a helicopter pretty much,
especially if their reaction times are 5 times better than ours. You'd have no chance. Imagine trying to run away from a dragonfly.
Well, it would anticipate where you're going to go. So, you know, you'd think you'd find a good spot, you'd run, and it would just be there.
You'd have to do the worm dance in June, but much quicker. so they can't predict where you're going to walk next.
Just random direction at any point.
Yeah, exactly. No, amazing. Dragonflies are definitely up there with one of my kind of favourite animals. I've tried to photograph and film them many times. And do you know what? The success rate of my filming of a dragonfly is very low. but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. When you get the shot in slow motion, you see the dragonfly's wings beating. It's just, yeah, it's quite satisfying.
Anyway, so there you have it. Dragonflies, most efficient hunters in the world with 95% success rate. Not only do they react to their prey, but they predict where their prey is going to move to. And they can process information 5 times faster than us, which I think gives them the ultimate crown of the top hunters ever. Right, go on, James. What do you think you've got to top that?
Okay, well, as you said earlier, when it comes to hunting, you think of big lions in Africa. And rightly so, they've got some immense weaponry. They've got sharp claws, large, powerful jaws. But it turns out they aren't the most powerful in relation to their body size. So there's this measurement called the bite force quotient, which basically measures the power of an animal's bite in relation to its body size. Now, the crown, the winner, goes to a marsupial called the Tasmanian Devil.
Oh, I love the Tasmanian. I watched the cartoon as a kid.
Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. Was that the right one?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah, he never really spoke. He just dribbled a lot,
I think. Made noise. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a great animal.
Well, his bite force measures 181. In the bite force quotient, is 181, which doesn't really mean anything, but a lion's is 128.1.
That's a big, big difference.
A big difference. Now, do you know what a domestic dog is?
Oh, it's not much, is it? Go on.
It's actually more than you think. It's 114.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So they're in relation to their body size, they're only a little bit less than a lion. But the Tasmanian Devil is out on top with 181. Now, what's surprising, do you know what comes in third?
In relation to body size, I mean, I know jaguars have some of the biggest bite forces in the world.
Jaguar's about 11th.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm surprised by that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with something small, actually. I feel like something like a tenrec or like a small mammal like that.
You're on the right lines. Third is at least weasel.
A weasel, yeah, no, that makes sense. Tenerife weasel.
The weasels that we get in the UK is their bite force quotient is 164. So they're only 17 points off the top spot. They've got an incredible bite force.
It's quite something, isn't it?
So the weasel is the smallest member of the mustelid family in the world, and we have them in the UK. So to have this little little ninja running around with that powerful bite force is incredible. Now, my fact isn't on weasels, but it is on another mustelid. And that was really just to kind of get you into the power of mustelids, how powerful they can be. Because I'm going to be talking about the next biggest mustelid
right.
that we have in the UK, our stoat. A cute, slender little sprig of energy that is bigger than a weasel, but is our second smallest mustelid behind a polecat, behind a pine marten, badger and otter in length. And if you'd like to see the size difference of our mustelids, you can go to silhouettesclothing.co.uk, where I've designed a mustelid t-shirt, among other wildlife designs. There you go. Shameless plug for my t-shirts. Go check them out.
Very good. No, I do like your t-shirts. They are very cool. They are very cool. I do recommend them for anyone that wants to have a little peruse. It's not just mustelids, though, is there? There's birds of prey.
Just mustelids, birds of prey. There's seabirds, the newest one. There's loads of things you can look at.
I haven't got that one yet.
No, you've got it. Don't worry, I've got you one.
Ah, excellent.
Got to get you branded. anyway, let's talk about what makes a stoat so great. So, like a weasel, they have a very strong, powerful bite. They've got sharp teeth, got small sharp claws which they use for navigating their terrain, but their greatest asset really is their agility. They can run up to 20 miles per hour, which for an animal that's only 30 centimeters long is pretty fast. Now they live in a variety of different habitats, you know, moorland, woodland, farmland, grassland, but kind of they live wherever their prey can be found. You may find stoats as well. So they like to feed off of small rodents like voles and mice, but their favorite, their, I'm going to use your saying, creme de la creme.
I don't say that often.
You've said it quite a lot. Their creme de la creme of their prey is a rabbit. Now, stoats don't really like being out in the open. In fact, they like kind of like to stay hidden, and they only really come out when they're in pursuit of prey. So they stick to the crevices, the dense vegetation, and hide away as much as they can. In fact, in some parts of Scotland, stoats can go one step further and actually change their fur colour in winter to white to match the kind of the snowy landscape, or at least the historical snowy landscape. And when they do this transformation, they're then called an ermine, which is in relation to their Latin name. So they're fast, they're agile, they're sneaky. But possibly the most impressive fact is that they can take down prey that is 5 times larger than themselves. Prey that's can weigh up to 10 times more than they do. So they're only about 200 to 400 grams, the males being larger, and they can take down rabbits as heavy as 2 kilograms. That's an immense difference. That's like us trying to take down, I don't know, what weighs nearly a ton? Like a you know, something like a black rhinoceros.
Well,
they're about a ton.
You know,
imagine that. Imagine running up to a black rhino and thinking, right, I'm going to eat you. I'm going to take you down. This is what the stoats are doing in equivalent.
It's quite impressive. It takes guts. It takes balls to be able to be like, that's what I want and I'm going to go after it. I mean, you got to hand it to them, the confidence just to do that.
Well, you say confidence. I'd say they're psychotic. And I'm going to tell you for why in a minute. So they're pretty successful hunters. About 60% of the time, they end in a kill. So what they do is they chase after their prey animal and they deliver a very strong bite right to the back of the neck, and that's a very quick way to kill their prey. So 60% success rate, so not as good as dragonflies, but in predator terms, that's pretty high. But I have to tell you, these cute little mustelids have a very sinister, verging on psychotic side.
Right.
So after they kill their prey, they often take over their homes. So whether that's a warren or a den or even a nest, they'll kill their victim and then take over its home and makes it its own.
It's like psycho killer Goldilocks.
Yeah, exactly. This one's just right. So it's pretty ruthless. But they do go one step further again. So in order to keep their new homes nice and warm, they will often line it with the fur of their victims. Almost like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, wearing the skins of the
you know
victims.
What? It's always the cute ones. It's always the cute ones. Deceiving.
Like butter wouldn't melt, but well, actually, they skin their victims and use the fur as a nice lining for their nice new homes that they can keep nice and warm in during the winters. They're absolutely psychotic.
Mm.
Now, and they can have several dens, by the way, so they have to do a lot of killing in order to keep all of their dens nice and warm. So that's, you think, the number of rabbits, number of voles that they have to decimate in order to basically just to keep fed and warm.
Yeah, and I guess as well, if they're kind of defecating in those dens, I mean, that fur is going to become quite, that rabbit fur is going to become quite less puffy and less insulating pretty quick.
Yes, they probably have to renew that, their new lining quite frequently mm-hmm. as well. So these are psychopaths. Now,
add salt to the injury.
Exactly. There's one stoaty fact, which is kind of in debate, but pretty cool if it is true. It might be more anecdotal than it is scientific, and I think there's more that is yet to be seen with this. But stoats have been witnessed in doing what's called a war dance, or the dance of death. So apparently what they've been seen to do is do lots of jumping and rolling and twisting and jerking in front of a rabbit or a vole or something in order to create this kind of confusion. So by kind of flopping around on the ground, they kind of hypnotize almost their prey. And in doing so, they can kind of sneak closer and closer. They can kind of dance around, getting closer and closer and closer to a rabbit, so they can then quickly grab it and kill it, which is mental. If that was true, which I hope it is, again, there's been quite a few sightings of this behavior, it would be incredible. But there is a sort of a flip side, is that they do... Sometimes stoats can get this kind of parasite which causes them to kind of do this behavior. It's a parasite that I think is behind in their brain or behind their eyes or in their nasal cavities or something.
Mm.
And basically it causes them to flip out. But this has been seen in like a predatory process of catching and killing something. So I don't know, it could very well be true that they do this dance of death in order to get close to their animals. But regardless of this, they are still very effective predators. And actually, so much so, they've been a massive problem in New Zealand.
Mm, yeah.
So in the 19th century, rabbits basically were taking over New Zealand. Rabbits were brought over by European settlers, and they're not native, so they were kind of ruining the habitat, you know. So they thought, great, I know what we can do. What likes a rabbit? A stoat. We'll get a load of stoats in, we'll bring them in, they'll kill all the rabbits, job's a good one. Now, a lot of scientists protested against this. They're like, no, it's going to be disastrous. And of course it was, because they started to decimate some of those native bird populations, because they are incredibly tenacious, very agile, very effective. And of course, if they're in a habitat where there's rabbits and birds and other native things, they're going to go for those as well. So it's a pretty bad example of terrible terrible decision making when it comes to conservation.
Yeah, I mean, non-natives are a disaster anywhere, but in a place like New Zealand, having things like stoats, but also, you know, rats, which were introduced as well with Polynesian settlers that arrived and then European settlers that arrived, terrible, because New Zealand is full of ground nesting birds. We know that, yeah. You know, historically New Zealand had no large ground predators, so birds evolved to hide from, you know, the predators in the sky and became ground dwelling. You get things like the kiwi and the kakapo, and we know that it's just been a disaster for them having, you know, stoats and rats and things.
And they're tenacious, that they are very, you know, they're driven psychopaths, because they were actually found 5 kilometers away on a smaller island, 5 kilometers away from the main island.
But they're good swimmers.
They're good. They're really good swimmers. They did tests on stoats to see how well they could swim, and they put them in these kind of like tanks which create like a current, like a wave. And they recorded a stoat basically swimming at a moderate current for 2 hours without stopping, so doing the equivalent of nearly 2 kilometers. They did a test on a stoat, and it was like, yeah, it's fine, no worries at all.
Yeah,
it can get its 100-meter badge easy.
Oh, I remember that proud moment getting my 100, 200 meter badge. It's great.
Do you want to go for a 5 kilometer one?
Absolutely. Why not?
The stoat award, yeah?
The stoat award. They're just, I mean, in the right place, I'm really impressed by stoats. You know, they're incredibly damaging because of their hunting techniques elsewhere, in places where they shouldn't be. But they are, you have to kind of respect them for their devious, dangerous nature. Dangerous deviance.
I'd say dangerous, deadly, psychopathic predators.
But to be a top predator, you have to become, I don't know, you have to one-up your prey, don't you? You have to think of ingenious ways, because your prey gets used to your tactics. You then have to one-up them. So, I mean, yeah, again, me being fascinated by the morbid, I love them. I really do.
So there you go. What do you prefer? Do you prefer the Darts of Death, the Dragonflies, or the Dance of Death by the Stoats?
I think that's probably one of my favourite little analogies or sum ups that you've done so far. That's good. Very, very good. But yes, you can have your vote over on Twitter or X, if you want to be modern, right now. So make sure that you make your way over to the Frogs Bollocks Twitter account. And please, please do have your say. It's really important to us because we're really getting close to the crunch now on who's going to have to do the final forfeit at the end of the series. So we really need you to tell us which is your favourite.
As always, thank you so much to everyone who's been sending in their questions and stories. Do keep them coming, and you can email us at info@thefrogsbollocks.com or reach out on our social media.
Right, so I have a question for you, and this is from Matt on Instagram. Is it okay to feed wildlife in the garden, specifically related to foxes?
Okay. Well, it's one of the best British pastimes of feeding animals in the garden. I think the UK is one of the biggest spenders of bird food in the world. We like to feed our garden birds, and rightly so. They brighten up our gardens, and they're immense fun to watch. In terms of feeding foxes, if you do it in a safe, respectful, and healthy manner, then giving foxes a supplement. Now, I put the onus on supplement because you should never have animals reliant on you.
No.
If you're feeding animals in your garden, you don't want them reliant, because what happens if you go on a holiday for a couple of weeks or you move home? Those animals are then reliant on that food source, and when they go to it, you're not there, and they then have to move territories or they have to go elsewhere, and you're putting them under immense pressure and immense, you know, you're putting them at risk, really, if you're not there to feed them. So the best thing you can do is only ever feed them a supplement. So, for example, like the badgers we're talking about, I only ever put out a scattering of peanuts, no more than that. They have a quick little snack, and then they carry on, and they go about their daily lives feeding on earthworms and all sorts of other things. The same for feeding birds in the garden. If you're feeding birds 24/7, 365 days a year, those birds potentially become reliant on that food source. So one of the best practices you can do is by putting the bird feeders up and having them, you know, full of seeds and peanuts and fat balls. But after a while, take them down for a couple of weeks or a month or whatever. Allow them to sort of disperse and move around. And that's kind of a best practice. It also allows you to clean your feeders. That's one of the most important things that you can do, is clean your feeders, because there's lots of different viruses and conditions out there that are affecting our garden birds. Just one final point. There's this amazing sort of study area called zoo pharmacognosy. I think I'm saying that right. Whereby basically animals selectively choose their food types to treat their own conditions.
Yeah.
So there are some tests you can do. My friend at university, Katie, she actually did a film about this on a lady who was in her garden putting out these different kind of natural food sources and seeing what the fox in her garden would choose. And a fox that had mange would pick a food that would help its mangy condition. It wasn't going for, you know, the high calorie or the high energy content. It was sensing that this food was the right food to treat its condition and was eating it. And that's one of the things you can do in your garden as well, is by having a variety of food sources available, the animals can then make their decisions and then make the right choices that most benefit their own health.
Yeah, totally agree with that. I mean, it's like, you know, when we need to hydrate, we might go and pick up a cucumber or something with a higher water content. You know, we know what our body needs, and so do animals. The other thing that I would say, just to add to your point though, is like I've always fed the foxes in particular, like ever since I was a kid. However, I always go and put food out in the daytime when they're not there, and I always put it as far away from my house as possible, and I make sure that I am not there whilst foxes are, and this is very specific to foxes, make sure I'm not there whilst they're around, because I don't want them to come used to me. I don't want them to get used to a people presence, because ultimately, whilst I love them, if they then go to the next door neighbor's house and start asking for food, my next door neighbor might not like them so much. So for their own protection and their own safety, I do give them the scraps of the food occasionally, but I make sure that I step back and I don't want them to know that it's me that's providing it, because it's for their own safety, really.
I've got a question for you, which you've actually had from quite a few people messaging in, which are basically saying, how do I get a career in conservation or in wildlife or in natural sciences? How do I get a career in those areas?
Very good question. And I wish I had a kind of a more definite answer. The thing I would suggest to people, and I say this quite a lot, and obviously it's a very privileged thing to be able to do, but if you're able to go and volunteer, highly recommend it, because you're able to really pinpoint exactly what area of conservation that you're interested in. So I started volunteering at my local wildlife hospital when I was like 11 or 12 years old, and got to know, you know, and help rear baby birds and fox cubs and things like that, which was really lovely. And because I'm dyslexic and not very good at academic side of things, I wanted to focus on the practical side of things. I did a lot of volunteer placements, you know, with lots of different animals. I think that's a really good way to start, is have as much practical experience under your belt as you possibly can get, but also just kind of keep building up those relationships with people that you meet, because often a team will get to know you and a door will open for a paid opportunity, a job, and that's really good. The issue with conservation, and it is changing, I definitely see a lot more paid internships coming around, is the fact that, you know, you have to kind of have volunteer experience and you don't get paid for it a lot of the time, and it's really hard because not everyone can afford to work for free. So it is kind of building up the relationships wherever you can, whether that's just going and visiting a place, speaking to people, building up something on social media, perhaps, to gain those connections. That's a really good way to kind of get into it. But yeah, I would suggest doing that. But if you are looking at volunteer placements, the one thing I would say is that it is a minefield. Do not go for a volunteer placement which is going to cost you thousands of pounds for you to go out and work for a week in a place, because essentially you're paying for a glorified holiday and you won't gain the skills and experience that you really need to progress in conservation. It has become a bit of a money-making scam. So I always recommend, if you want to go and volunteer, especially abroad, find a charity that you love, find something you're interested in, approach them and ask them directly whether they have any opportunities. You should have to pay for your travel, that's kind of expected, and potentially a little bit of maintenance towards the building that you're staying in, but otherwise food and everything should be paid for by that organisation. You shouldn't have to shell out thousands of pounds to go and work for someone else for free. And that's my rant. Now it's time for this week's special guest, and our expert today is somebody who explores the most remote parts of the planet. Eva Stewart is a fantastic PhD student at the Natural History Museum, and she studies deep sea animals in the Pacific Ocean, many of which are entirely new to science. And her research is going towards our understanding of these elusive creatures and their relation to mining on the seafloor.
Hi, my name is Eva Stewart and I am a PhD student at the Natural History Museum in London, and my research looks at the diversity of invertebrates that live on the deep sea floor, and particularly looking at how these might be impacted by deep sea mining. So while I've been doing my PhD, I've been really fortunate to spend quite a lot of time at sea on research cruises. And last year I spent actually over 3 months of the year at sea on the James Cook, which is a UK research vessel. And there really isn't a typical day to day when you're at sea, because everything changes so quickly. Ships operations run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So while you're at sea, you work a 12 hour shift every day, which sounds quite tiring, but you really get used to quite quickly. And everything's so exciting, it really goes quite quick. Something I wish people knew about the deep sea is just how beautiful and how diverse the animals are. I think people typically, when you say deep sea to them, think of like really scary, horrible things like big anglerfish with huge jaws and stuff like that, when actually the majority of deep sea animals don't really look like that. And there's all kinds of weird and wonderful and beautiful things down there. And people also often think of the deep sea as being quite empty and not being very diverse, as it's so deep and so dark, there's no light to fuel any photosynthesis. But actually, it's incredibly diverse. And in some areas of the deep sea, we find that the animals are more diverse than in shallow waters. And this is something we still don't really know why. This makes it a really exciting and interesting environment to work in, because there are still so many questions and so many things left to discover. We estimate that in the area that we're working in, which is the Clarion-Clipperton Zone in the Pacific Ocean, about 90% of the animals we collect are new to science and haven't been seen before. However, taxonomy just is not a very well-funded form of science. It's typically quite hard to get any grant funding for it, but it really is very hard work and requires really specialist knowledge and skills. And despite this being really fundamental to all other aspects of biology and ecology, because you can't answer questions about an ecosystem or try and conserve it if you don't know what lives there, it's really underappreciated as a science. So were I all powerful, I would give more money to people trying to describe new species, but also really try and promote it, and so more people know about it, because I think it's something most people don't really realise goes on behind the scenes in museums. Over 70% of our planet is ocean, and 90% of that is the deep sea. So the majority of our planet is deep sea, and this plays a really important part in the functioning of our oceans and our planet as a whole. The deep sea plays really important roles in various ecosystem services, such as supporting fisheries, which we eat from. People are quite regularly finding new drugs, such as antibiotics and anti-cancer drugs, from deep sea animals. And it also plays a role in the mitigation of climate change through the storage of carbon in things like coral skeletons. However, I also think that just because something provides a service to us shouldn't be the only reason that we care about it. And actually, the deep sea is home to a huge variety of really beautiful, unusual animals that you can't find anywhere else. And this in and of itself should be a reason for us to care about and love and want to protect the deep sea.
But the deep sea is just an incredible place. Imagine being down at those depths, seeing things that very few people, if anyone, has ever seen before.
I know. I'd love to be down there. I mean, we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean and the life down there.
Yeah.
It is just alien, to say the least. And I think that's why it's just so interesting. But also, it's so fragile. You know, we often think about our impacts where we can see them, but the fact that there's plastic at the bottom of the Mariana Trench and all this stuff, deep sea mining that goes on, you know, deep sea sharks being harvested for their oil that goes into our makeup products, like all this stuff we really need to be talking about more, because we do impact the deep sea. Even though we can't see it, it's still very much there.
Yeah, even though it's out of sight, it should not be out of mind.
Absolutely not. And that's why I love Eva and her work. I think she's just fascinating, and I want to go and work in a lab for a bit. I really do.
So at the end of every podcast, we like to kind of do a takeaway section, something you can get from us that you can implement in your kind of natural world.
Yes. Well, I have a short one very quickly, just something to flag, something to think about. And I was thinking about it a lot this previous Earth Day. Now, Earth Day comes around every single year and there is a lot of hype around it, and rightly so. But in my opinion, Earth Day shouldn't just be one day. It should be every single day. We need to be considering our planet and all the actions that we do. But I did notice on social media there are a lot of companies jumping on the Earth Day bandwagon, and it was like, buy this Earth Day t-shirt or buy this Earth Day product. And it was, again, encouraging over consumerism. It makes me question, you know, is Earth Day beneficial? Are we getting more positives from that? Or actually, is it a bit of a hoax and an entire greenwashing scheme? I was just thinking, it's just a thought that I wanted to flow out there to get people to think about, really, because, you know, Earth Day should be every day, and it should not be used to promote brands and businesses that put profit over planet.
Yeah, exactly. I think it started out with really good intentions, and I think that, you know, the Earth Day kind of organization and Earth Day kind of message is very good.
Yeah.
But like you say, so many people jump on it and use it as a greenwashing scheme just to make a load of money. But yeah, you said it perfectly, that we shouldn't be treating the natural world as if it's fixable in a day, or should only be considered in a day. We should be working on it 24/7, which actually kind of relates to my point in some ways. I was going to do a little takeaway this week as well.
Oh, excellent. Go on.
So my takeaway this week is I have a little bit of a bugbear with something that I know quite a lot of people really like, and I'm probably going to be really unpopular here, but I don't think we should be doing No Mow May. Okay, I've said it. I've talked to you about this a lot. I know I'm controversial.
You have.
But let me explain
why. It is controversial, but go for it.
Let me explain why. So I don't think we should do No Mow May. I think we should do No Shear All Year. That's what I'm saying. That's my
no
coin phrase. Or no... slash, in, I don't know. Because, simply, if you let your garden grow wild for a month, you don't cut the grass, you let it grow wild, you let all the flowers come up, 1 month, things move into that habitat and they're looking for their forever home. So if you're going to cut that home down after a month, then that's not going to be good for the things that are living in it. Not only do you displace them, but you potentially risk damaging them. Not only that, though, is that a lot of the flowers that emerge, they need to be able to seed in order to germinate, you know, in order to produce more flowers. And if you're cutting all of the flowers down and all of the grasses down at the end of May, they won't have had time to do this germination, which often takes place kind of later on in the summer. So what I really want people to do is be able to give part of their garden up for wildlife. So I'm not expecting everyone to, you know, let their entire lawn go crazy and go wild. But if you can do a border, a corner, you know, some pots that you can let grow a bit wilder and leave them wild for as long as you possibly can in the year, that's going to be so much more beneficial because things are going to be living in there. They're going to be laying their eggs in there. They're going to be, you know, creating nests and all sorts of things. So if you can do no shear all year, that's going to be far better than doing it just for a month. You know, the only thing that benefits in that short space of time are some of the pollinators, but like I said, some of those pollinators, like butterflies, they'll be laying their eggs potentially in your garden, which you're then gonna chop up and churn up and kill. So I recommend, if you can, give over a tiny bit of your garden as much as you possibly can to no shear all year. And honestly, people say it's untidy. It's not. If you get loads of dandelions and all these loads of different, you know, buttercups and daisies, you'll get potentially forget-me-nots, oxide, all these sorts of things. They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, they're incredible. You don't have to do what we do. You know, I've actually made a full-blown meadow, which goes mental every year.
It's not big,
but it's
though.
Beautiful.
It's not like, you know, traditional meadow size, but it's like a plot,
it's not a field.
It's not a field.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little garden that I dug up all the grass and put some native wildflower seeds in. So that's my recommendation, is no shear all year. And if you've got a better saying for that, let me know. But I think no shear all year is quite good.
Yeah. Well, I think you're scraping the bottle of the barrel there with the rhyme, but I like your concept. I think it's really important that we're talking about that. Obviously, it's a transition. And for some people, not mowing their lawn for a month is like a little act of rebellion, and it is kind of sitting within the parameters of what they're comfortable with. It has to be a transition, but I totally agree with you. The longer that we can leave it, the better for all kinds of animals, not just the ones that are out and about and doing their thing in May, but for the things that come later. And you know, after as well. So yes, I entirely agree with your concept. I think it's very valid and a very good takeaway point for people to hopefully practice in their own green spaces.
So that's it. That's the end of episode 8 of the Frog's Bollocks. We've been really enjoying every episode so far. We hope you have too. We are not bickering too much, even though the competition is heating up.
Oh, it's getting, I can feel the heat from all these miles away from you. But if you can, I can't believe, James, we've actually forgotten a huge part of the podcast and we've never said it before.
Oh, right.
And I'm going to say it now because it's really cringy, but it's a little ask for everyone at home. Can you please like and subscribe to our podcast? It really means the world if you're able to rate us, tell us what you think of it on the platform, because it does us the world of good in getting up and getting the podcast heard and listened by more people.
Yeah. I can't believe you've never said that before. It is very cringy. Like, share, subscribe.
It is cringy. Like, share, subscribe. But the thing is, we've never done that before. And it's quite an important ask, actually. It does mean quite a lot for podcast ratings and things.
We've been receiving some lovely comments and lovely messages. You know, all the feedback you get really helps us, you know, keep going. And it makes us know that we're doing something good, hopefully. We're not too bad at this. We're hopefully engaging you and entertaining you. So, yeah, please let us know if you like our show.
So that's it for episode 8. Thank you so much for joining. It's been a privilege. And remember to have your vote on Twitter and get in contact with us if you have any wildlife questions burning at the back of your brain. You are, 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 the Frog's Bollocks.